The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra season opens on Sunday with a concert at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. It's called Symphonic Evolution, and the conductor, Andrew Kohler, is back to talk about the program. It's so nice to see you. I've been waiting all fall to have you back at WMUK.
Oh, that's very kind. Thanks, Kara. I've been waiting all fall to be back.
So your season with the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra opens this week, mm-hmm. and next week the Kalamazoo Philharmonia opens. So we'll be doing back-to-back
interviews. Yeah, exactly. That's always the way it seems to work out in the fall, right?
That's true.
The schedules line up very closely, and then they start spreading apart as the year goes on.
Well, tell me about the new crop of students and young performers, many of whom I'm sure are continuing on from past years.
Well, interesting you should say that. Actually, not as many as you might suspect. This has been a big rebuilding year for us. The orchestra is a bit smaller than it's been in the past. And I think someone said, gosh, I can't remember the exact number, but it was somewhere well into the 40% range of the orchestra that we lost to graduation last year. So there were considerable pairs of shoes to be filled. And, you know, some wonderful new musicians have entered the orchestra, but it's, on average, a newer group. This is the natural life cycle of a youth orchestra, you know, and this is how things happen. The group that we had last year had tended to have already been in the orchestra, those seniors, for several years. So we had had a good amount of time together to kind of build on a sort of longer path. And they've, many of them have gone on to, well, all of them have gone on to college of some sort or another. That's one of the things that we're very proud of at the Junior Symphony, that I think it's well over 99% of our students go to college. But now we have new students who will eventually follow those predecessors and are doing their very best to get in the groove, as it were, with the new orchestra.
It is interesting to think about how each of those seniors created a model and probably a great deal of assistance to the inexperienced players and the effect that each of them had on three or four other players in the orchestra.
You know, I can still remember being in a youth orchestra myself, and it's so interesting to note how profound an effect age seems to have at that time in one's life. So what I mean to say is, when I entered as a high school sophomore, I remember thinking the seniors in the group were impossibly seasoned and old and knowledgeable. You know, I mean, I really looked at them as if they were demigods or something like that. And, you know, in some cases, I've met those people now in my professional musical life as an adult. And I still have this impression that somehow they're so much older than I am, but when they're really only a year or two older than I am. But I really do think that's exactly that effect that you're referencing. You know, the wonderful thing about youth orchestras are that the musicians in them are at an age where there's such plasticity in their music making still, right? And in their ability to learn things. The progress that can be made in a single season sometimes is really astonishing to me. That's one of the things that makes me sort of constantly excited to come back to something like the Junior Symphony to see those six particularly dramatic success stories where someone comes in as a sort of middling something or other at first, and then by the end of a year seems to have really caught on fire and come so far. And you're absolutely right. Then in turn, they can maybe transmit that to a new student who's coming on board.
The sophomore who never thought she would be, a leader, is now having to step up and be that person.
Yeah.
The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra season begins Sunday at 4 o'clock with a program called Symphonic Evolution, which is in a way what we've been talking about as the musicians turn over. But tell me more specifically what this program represents.
Well, you know, I got to thinking about the symphony, and I mean that in terms of the symphony as a genre of music.
Something that we accept today as just, oh, it's the symphony. It's
inevitable,
this thing with four movements.
But amazingly so. It's so iconic, right, that the very name of the group that plays that piece of music is named after it, right? I mean, those become synonymous, right? So it's so profoundly linked, but it didn't necessarily look all the time in music history like it was going that way. The symphony was really a product of the classical era in the 18th century, and then many in the 19th century were thinking its time was done. Schumann wrote extensively about how he thought surely now there was no more point in composing this sort of stuff. And then he was sort of convinced otherwise late in his life, and then others were. And then, fast forward to several decades later, we have Johannes Brahms still writing symphony, and then Gustav Mahler still writing symphonies. And we still even have Americans writing symphonies through the 20th century. And even today, Chris Theofanidis, for example, a great contemporary composer, has a first symphony that's a really wonderful piece of music. And so somehow this genre, this idea of the symphony, has really had lasting power. And, it's been almost 300 years and counting at this point that it's been going on. And so I started to think how interesting it is that we as musicians seem to have a sense that a symphony means something, that this, if somebody writes a symphony, that carries a certain kind of weight. But what exactly is it? Because they're all so different, and it's this beautiful sort of delicate interplay between certain characteristics that stay consistent and then other characteristics that are ultimately very malleable so that it can be translated into the voice of any number of other composers. I think, for example, of someone like Rimsky-Korsakov, who did write some symphonies, but then his Symphony Number 2, it's often still referred to as Symphony Number 2, the Antar Symphony, which I did several years back with the Philharmonia. That was a piece where he equivocated. He kept going back and forth. Oh, it's a symphony. No, it's a symphonic suite. No, I'm going to call it a symphony. No, it's not really a symphony. I shouldn't call it a symphony. So he had all this he felt this weight of history on him in a way that, as many other composers did. You think about Brahms too, right? Waiting until he was in his 40s to write his first symphony. This sense that this really meant something to write a symphony. So I wanted to investigate, dedicate a program to investigating what exactly it means. What are the similarities and what are the things that can be changed? So we take kind of a snapshot of this evolving symphony from three different eras. We begin with a Mozart symphony, a very early Mozart symphony, the number 7. And as you can imagine, when you get into numbers like 7 with Mozart, we're talking about a 12-year-old composing.
Right.
And this is indeed, he was exactly 12 years old when he wrote this. And of course, you would never know it. It's brilliant and it's wonderful. But it's also an early symphony or an earlier symphony in the evolution, and it dates to very close to its origins as an opera overture, which is really where the symphony comes from. The symphony is the sinfonia, the operatic sinfonia of the Italian opera house. And by that time in the early classical era, there was already kind of a pattern that a lot of composers were using for those orchestral overtures that were meant to sort of hush up the crowd and get everyone's attention. As I just suggested, it needs to start kind of dramatically to get the audience's attention. And then usually there's a more lyrical bit in the middle. And then at the end, there was often either a dance or a sort of fast, gallopy thing that kind of summed things up and got people excited for the drama to come. And that succession of moods started to translate into separate movements in a symphony when they actually got transferred to the concert stage in the hands of people like Haydn and Mozart. And certainly they weren't the first to write these symphonies, but Haydn and Mozart were the ones who really started making the language of the symphony more and more sophisticated and maybe added its other fundamental characteristic, which is the idea of developing the musical ideas in them very thoroughly. So it's not just a potpourri of melodies, right? But rather an idea that is clearly constructed and then deconstructed and then manipulated and developed and then eventually returns in full. And that kind of thoroughness is probably one of the most lasting legacies of the symphony. So perhaps we can take a little listen to a bit of the 7th symphony of Mozart, this 12-year-old Mozart. And another amazing thing about this is we will perform 3 symphonies actually on Sunday, and that won't be an overly long concert, as some of your listeners may be frightened to think, because the Mozart only lasts 10 minutes, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. 4 movements will take no more than 10 minutes to perform.
I'm excited to hear this. This is not a symphony I've listened to.
ever? I don't know.
Yeah, I confess I didn't know it either. And I wanted specifically to look to an early symphony that had the four movements that we've come to recognize as the standard. Because at that time, as I mentioned, the Italian opera overture usually only had a dance or a fast bit. Eventually, it became standard to have the dance and a fast bit and make those all four separate movements. Mm-hmm. So medium fast, then something slow, then something dance, then something quite fast. And indeed, the Mozart is already heading in this direction, as you can hear in this Seventh Symphony.
We heard two short movements of four short movements from a symphony by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Very charming music. How old was he again when he wrote this piece?
Just 12. Makes you kind of angry, doesn't it? Well, sort of admiring, yeah, but also a little bit angry.
I think Korngold impresses me more, actually.
Mm. Yeah, in some ways, there people have pointed out how, for example, you know, this is brilliant and charming, but definitely less sophisticated than his later material. Whereas, on the other hand, someone like Mendelssohn, for example, seemed already to create some of his most lasting and memorable masterpieces already as a teenager. But I don't know. This is as Bartok said, you know, competition is for horses, not for artists.
The program is called Symphonic Evolution, and it begins with the early symphony by Mozart, mm-hmm. partly as an example of how the symphony was defined in its very early stages.
Exactly right. Yeah. So, you know, you can still hear, for example, in that first movement, or actually the second movement provides a lovely example too. There's a really consistent kind of motivic link, you know, throughout the entire thing. There are these steady triplets that keep chugging along in the second violins, and there's this idea of a long, low held note followed by two pairs of slurred notes after that. And that notion, you know, he keeps putting it in slightly different keys and on slightly different harmonies, and it gets transferred into other parts, but basically that's the idea that seems to unite everything. And that's kind of what I mean when I say there's this thoroughness to the working out of the musical material. It's not simply here's one nice tune and then here's another, but rather that he takes that and he really explores that theme, putting it in different key areas, maybe combining it in different ways, and then eventually hearing a theme in full again. So that kind of motivic craftsmanship was one of the things that came to be a real hallmark of the symphony. And obviously here it's done on a relatively modest scale because this is still only lasting but a few minutes. And its relationship, again, to the opera overture is particularly close. I also admired this piece for that fact, because this very music, though it was originally written as a symphony, was then changed back into an opera overture subsequently by Mozart for La Finita Semplice, I think. Another one of his early mm-hmm. operas. He was also writing operas as a tween. So, you know, it just shows that sort of very almost still fuzzy kind of borders between those two genres, and how something from the opera house could come to the symphonic stage and then even go back to the opera house once again.
It's so interesting that one would still remain the preview, the taster of the tunes to come in the opera, the opera overture, and one would go to be, for its own sake, the working out of musical ideas, but with a similar big opening,
right?
A lovely aria like adagio,
exactly,
and some dance music.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and I think the composers as instrumental music in the 18th century continued to gain in importance. Composers saw the inherent possibilities, the lovely contrasts, the balanced structure of this form, and saw its possibilities for really captivating an audience on the concert stage. Certainly, that's why Haydn gets this nickname, Father of the Symphony. A lot of people assume that must mean that if he's the father of the symphony, that he was the first to write symphonies. And again, that's not really the case, but it is the case that he lent sophistication to these symphonies. He really started pushing this, even going further with these ideas that we're hearing just little bits of in Mozart, you know, the motivic development of ideas.
And he needs some title for having written
104 numbered plus extras that they're still discovering, absolutely. But that also goes to show you how early on in his career those symphonies were relatively smaller affairs, right? That he was able to write so many of them because by the time he gets to 104, it's amazing. If you look at that stretch of symphonies that Haydn wrote, the early ones tend to be for an orchestra like what Mozart's writing for right now. That is to say, two oboes, two horns, maybe trumpets and timpani, as the Mozart does use, but not all symphonies would use, and a string complement. That's it, a very small sort of core, and then again, a very short symphony, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 12 minutes to perform, something like that. And then steadily, the sophistication develops, the ideas get stretched out a little bit more, and the orchestra keeps getting bigger. So by the time we get to the end of Haydn's symphonies, or the end of Mozart's symphonies, we see the orchestra already taking shape in the way that we recognize it. We see two flutes, and we see two oboes, and we see now even two clarinets at the very end. They were the last to be added. And then also two bassoons. Still usually only two horns. That would continue to grow through the 19th century. And then trumpets and timpani and a larger string complement. And then those forces obviously just continue to grow as the 19th century goes on. You think of something like Mahler, you know, writing an hour and a half long symphony for, you know, four flutes and eight horns and, you know, just keep pushing that envelope. But where we pick up with the story now is kind of in the generation right after Haydn and Mozart had sort of taken the symphony to that level. And it's with the music of Beethoven, of course,
right.
Who was, I mean, no story of the symphony can be told without the presence of Ludwig van Beethoven.
I think if you asked the average person on the street, name a composer who wrote a symphony, Beethoven would always be the first answer. He wrote only 9 of them.
That's right, which again speaks a little bit to how much more sophisticated, how much more effort they cost him, and how much bigger these works were. And even that person on the street scenario that you just mentioned, if they were to name one of those symphonies, it would most likely be the one that we're going to perform, the Fifth Symphony, which is surely the most famous. You know, Beethoven had already... Beethoven, in many ways, inherited this sort of later version of the symphony that I was just describing from Haydn and Mozart, that final variant sophistication, maybe about 25 minutes in length or so for an orchestra with two horns and a full woodwind complement. And he takes that, and of course, Beethoven being Beethoven, just injects it with unspeakable amounts of drama. You know, he was just at the cusp of a kind of new thinking, I think, musically, and that is to say, Mozart and Haydn would have been, especially, you know, in the 1790s or so, just as Beethoven was cutting his teeth, more concerned with ideas of balance and a kind of characteristic gentility. You know, they were looking to amuse and delight their audiences. Beethoven was feeling much more like he wanted to shock his audiences. There's a beautiful anecdote about a teacher of Hector Berlioz, the French composer, listening to the Fifth Symphony for the first time, and he was at this point an elderly man, and he described his reaction afterwards. He said, I almost forgot to get my hat when I left the theater because I couldn't figure out where my head was. I was so shaken by this music, this Fifth Symphony, the incredible vigor, the drama of it, and it really is an extraordinary thing. So you really hear how the gentility of the Mozart that we just listened to turns into the most incredibly fiery presentation in Beethoven's hands. And yet, And yet, we still see a lot of those same characteristics in place. He's taking, in the Fifth Symphony, about a half-hour-long symphony, which is not necessarily much longer than what we had experienced with late Haydn or Mozart. Same size of orchestra. The motivic development is also there. You know, in fact, Beethoven even seems to go further with it. We think of that ba 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 bi, that famous iconic motive in the first movement, and that weaves its way through every part of that first movement. And I think even though it's probably surely familiar to listeners, it's so exciting to listen to each time. And I think we ought to give that first movement of the Beethoven a little bit of airtime here.
That's the opening movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. My guest, if you tuned in during that brilliant music, is Andrew Kohler, the conductor of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, which will perform Beethoven's full Fifth Symphony on Sunday at 4 o'clock. The program, as we've been talking about, is called Symphonic Evolution, and of course you must include Beethoven. My question for you, though, is as the conductor of a youth symphony, there are people who've only been on this earth for, 13, 14, 15 years. It's possible they may not have heard much more than just the ba-ba-ba-ba part of the symphony.
I think it's definitely very possible. And in our first rehearsals, it sounded like that might definitely be the case, that some of them had not heard all of this music before. Yeah. There are definite moments in one's life as an educator when you, this is sort of an aside as an anecdote, but I remember thinking, this was actually at Kalamazoo College a few years ago. Somebody was giving a presentation in one of my classes, and they started to talk about, the events of 9/11 and started recounting them. And I remember sort of scribbling a note to myself, kind of like, well, that's sort of unnecessary. Who doesn't remember what happened in 9/11? And then at some point he said, we were 5 at the time that it happened. And I couldn't get over it. I just couldn't imagine, someone being that age. But one has to take into account that not everyone would know. But I have to say, in fairness, that there was one of the reasons that we are doing the Fifth Symphony, among others, is that it was, I always ask the orchestra, what would they like to play? And this was a specific request from one of the violinists in the orchestra. So, when it fits and when I think it will work well for the symphony, I'm always happy to take those requests from the orchestra and do the things that they're excited about. So it was definitely on some radar screens.
The way I hear Beethoven, even if I pretend I haven't heard the music before, there is something about the way the parts lock together that must be very satisfying to both rehearse and perform.
Yeah, it's very difficult as well. But when you finally get it, I mean, that particular figure, it seems so innocuous, those three repeated notes, right? But they're written famously with a rest at the beginning of them. So sometimes it can sound as if they just start right with the pop, 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 but it's rest, pop, 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 bee. And over and over, you hear that's really how the main tune plays out, right? Pop, 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 bee, da, 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 da. And as that happens, the tendency in any orchestra, any large body of musicians, is when something starts with a rest, is to kind of overcount that rest a little bit and be slightly late to everything. So it's eternal vigilance that's needed to keep the music moving, really, really flowing, so it doesn't sound like we're always waiting for the next voice to slightly hesitate as it comes in on that same figure, which is, as you can hear, tossed about really all throughout the orchestra. You know, it'll go from the seconds to the clarinets to the firsts to other instruments in the strings, for example, and it's just a constant barrage of that idea. And that's one of the things, again, that is how Beethoven is souping up this notion of motivic development. Even when we have that big change, that big contrast in a second theme, which the part that goes ba-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-dum, if you listen carefully to the cellos and basses, you hear them intoning in the middle of that phrase, da-dee-da-dee-dee, ba-ba-ba-bum. Exactly, right? It's that same idea. It's ever-present in this music, you know? And that's part of what gives it this incredible vitality and energy. And I think that's particularly well captured by this legendary recording of the Vienna Philharmonic and Carlos Kleiber, which just is absolutely electric, isn't it?
It's the standard. But we're just talking about the first movement. There are three other movements in the work where Beethoven uses other techniques and strives for different effects and great beauty in the slow movement.
Absolutely right. And the slow movement has a beautiful kind of respite to it. There's a gentility to it, finally, and it is a much needed oasis after the sort of endless energy of the first movement. The third movement, which I think might be interesting to listen to, is the dance movement. So it's exactly, again, what we would expect in the position we would expect, even in that early Mozart symphony. We didn't quite get to it in the Mozart, but that third movement was a dance. It's a minuet, usually in a 3-4 time, a triple meter. So each pulse kind of feels like it has three component parts. In Beethoven's case, it's sped up quite a bit, but you still feel those three component parts, but they go along much faster. And again, the dance typically is written with an initial dance, a sort of middle dance, which is contrasting, and then it returns to the original dance. That's what Mozart did. That's what Beethoven does. Except Beethoven, of course, puts his own unique spin on it. And when that dance returns in the Fifth Symphony, it feels like a ghostly variant of the original. It follows it very closely, the same pattern of melody and the same melody itself. But you'll hear it's orchestrated very differently with pizzicato strings and a bassoon solo. But the last and most brilliant thing, if I may say, is, and this is what one of the things that makes this symphony so world-changing, is the notion that this motivic development that we were just talking about, that ba-ba-ba-bum, that idea, is not limited to the first movement. Movements had always been self-contained until this point, and then Beethoven started to push against that and break down those walls between movements. So what you'll hear very early on in this third movement is that same ba-ba-ba-bee, now heard differently. It's a great horn call, but you'll hear those emblematic three repeated notes. And then he takes the step. Then he goes a step further in this process, and this is the truly extraordinary thing. The third movement doesn't end in any proper sense. It just comes to a standstill, and then it slowly grows and launches us into the triumph of the fourth movement. And by doing that, and we'll listen a little into the fourth movement, by listening to that, we all of a sudden get the sense that this symphony is not simply four discrete movements that are charming and enjoyable to listen to on their own, but one continuous narrative journey, that we have gone from the terror of that opening that we just listened to the eventual triumph of this finale. Thank you.
We're in the middle of the final movement of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony. My guest is Andrew Kohler. The concert is Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chanery Auditorium when the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra opens its season with a program called Symphonic Evolution. That is how Beethoven linked his dance movement, the mm-hmm. traditional minuet or movement in three, into this triumphant final movement, as you described.
Yeah, and it's incredible. And even in the final movement, though, it is surely subtler than the reference in the third movement, where we hear those horns come pealing in with a thump, pum pum pee pum, which is that opening motive from the first movement. There's all over the place in the last movement too. For example, there's a passage in the development, dum 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 dum, and meanwhile, as this builds, the horns and trumpets are playing, yum da 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 dum 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 da 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 dum dim da 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 dum. There it is again, you know, just over and over again. I mean, laced throughout. It's really. I mean, of course, it's such a simple motive as it needs to be, you know. So it's infinitely malleable, but the degree to which there is a sense of cohesion in this music from the first note to the last is truly astonishing.
It's a request by one of the students in the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra to perform this work. It's also your job to introduce them to a wide variety of repertoire and kind of give them their first experience with some of the masterpieces in the repertoire. Mm. And that will really challenge their ability to perform it and endure a concert with so much music.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of, we always program, I think it's really important that we program full concerts. That is to say, I mean, you know, real, and that we do real music, that we really engaged with that, you know, and I understand that we might not always be able to offer the same perfection, perhaps, that the Vienna Philharmonic over there that we were just listening to can, but I know that we are better for that kind of engagement with the music.
So the big question, you've begun with a Mozart sort of baby symphony, mm-hmm. Then one of the iconic Beethoven symphonies. How do you bring us into this idea of evolution in time and in symphonic form?
Well, you know, I think maybe the next good step would have been to do a Mahler symphony, but as I mentioned, those tend to take at least 70 to 90 minutes to perform. So it would have been a little bit taxing on us and on the listeners to keep on going. We've just done a Mahler symphony, of course, last spring with the Junior Symphony, the second, and that was our whole concert.
Yeah.
So it wasn't terribly practical. So I had to sort of skip over that late romantic stage where the symphonies tended to get very long and very large. And kind of started looking in the post-World War I era where there was a turn again towards a kind of greater classical restraint. So in an interesting way, there was almost a kind of return to the symphonic size and scope that Beethoven would have known. That became fashionable once again, to a degree. Of course, after World War I, all kinds of new directions were emerging in music, but the symphony remained one of them. That was still something that a lot of composers wanted to cut their teeth on and sort of prove their mettle on. And so I came across, after the suggestions of a few trusted colleagues, the music of Randall Thompson. And I confess, I did not know this music very well, but the Symphony No. 2 is utter delight, and absolutely so assured. Randall Thompson was a composer, educated at Harvard, ended up teaching at Harvard, taught at Curtis for a little while as well, was a teacher of Leonard Bernstein, among others. You know, really, really made an impact as a teacher and educator, I think, and perhaps as a composer, most notably as a choral composer. That's really where the bulk of his output rests, which is why I think perhaps he wasn't on my radar screen as a primarily orchestral musician. But here's this early symphony from 1931, America, you know, mm-hmm. Depression-era America, and it is terrific. And once again, even though we couldn't be farther removed from Vienna, we have a lot of the same characteristics. So we have a four-movement symphony. The first movement is very tautly constructed and really relies on an opening motive that really grabs your attention and continues through, even through the second theme. It's very much, I think, an homage to Beethoven. I think it's very consciously so. A second movement that is, again, the slower movement, the gentler one, a kind of respite of sorts. A third movement that's a dance, and a dance that has those three sections, the first section, a kind of in-between section, and then a repeat of the first section again. And then a finale that's very upbeat. And in fact, as yet another homage to Beethoven, we didn't quite get there. We were just listening to it, but I hadn't mentioned yet that Beethoven, for the first time ever, uses trombones in the symphony. And he does so in that last movement. Randall Thompson does the same thing here. He withholds his trombones till the very end.
Well, Andrew, we have about 2 minutes left, so I just have to say I really appreciate you coming in to talk about this concert. Would you tell guests again what our listeners again what the details and time and place?
4 o'clock, Chenery Auditorium, Kalamazoo Junior Symphony, playing these three symphonies. And maybe just as a final thing, we can listen to a little bit of the beginning of that wonderful second symphony of Randall Thompson. Well, thanks, Kara.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.